Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the verse of Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land that we rarely ever sing, Guthrie wrote, "As I was walking, I saw a sign there. And on the sign there, it said no trespassing. But on the other side, it didn't say nothing. That side was made for you and me." And that seems to be the credo of my guest today. Moses Gates is an urban planner, assistant professor of demography at Pratt Institute in New York City, a licensed New York City tour guide, and urban explorer. Urban exploration means getting off the beaten path of exploring a city. And Gates believes the one way to truly know a city is by its landmarks that are off limits with signs to keep people out. That means abandoned subway stations, climbs to the top of the Brooklyn Bridge, the catacombs of Paris, a London lost river, or a closed-off New York City observation deck, or standing on one of the iconic eagles of the Chrysler Building. As he's found in the course of his explorations, officials really don't care. Those signs are basically to keep people out for their own safety. If you take the risk, much like being in the wilderness, you can enjoy the view. His account of these adventures and a loose network of like-minded individuals is titled Hidden Cities, a memoir of urban exploration, travels to the secret corners of the world's great metropolises. It's published by Tarcher Penguin, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Moses Gates, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
Now, you are an urban planner, but you're also what has come to be known as an urban explorer. What is an urban explorer in your mind exactly?
Well, it's just somebody who likes cities and wants to go see them and discover them. It can mean a whole bunch of different things, but it generally speaking means someone with a passion for a city that wants to see a city in a up-close kind of personal way.
Now, that is a large set. This book is a particular subset of that person who wants to see a city in detail. And when you mean in detail, you mean down subway tunnels, in catacombs, on top of bridges. And how would you describe what you like to do and what you write about in this book?
Well, so I like everything about cities. I like reading about them. I like walking around in them. I like studying them. And I also like getting a little bit off the beaten path and into those kind of places you described, which usually make for the best stories. But I would just describe it as following your curiosity, really. Everybody has things they're curious about, whether it's the natural world or the built environment or what have you. And we have trepidation about following our curiosity sometimes, and sometimes it's a valuable and correct trepidation, but sometimes it can get in the way of doing what you want to do and seeing some great stuff.
You know, you're doing in the built environment what mountain climbers do in the natural environment. Perhaps where the ropes of the boundary of the ski area are, you're crossing them, fully knowing that you proceed at your own risk. I think at the beginning of the book, you know, you relate the famous Woody Guthrie line of, you know, on one side of the sign, there was no trespassing sign and this land is your land, but there was nothing written on the other side. So I went on down the road. I'm paraphrasing the lyric,
right.
but that sort of seems to be a guiding ethos of what you're doing. How did you get started doing it?
There's really no secret, I suppose. It's just, I got curious about things and I got frustrated that I couldn't see everything I wanted to see and go where I wanted to go and do what I want to do. If you're a professional or if you have a passion, you want to explore that passion. You want to do everything you can to fulfill it. If you're a doctor and they don't let you in the operating room, you get frustrated. If you're a musician and they don't let you backstage, you get frustrated. If you're an urban planner and they don't let you into parts of the city, you get frustrated. And I decided that for a little while, at least, I was going to not let that frustration get in the way of what I wanted to do or where I wanted to go. And it was usually a good decision.
And what you found was it quickly became somewhat of an obsession.
Well, obsession's a strong word. I would go with passion. I think passion is a fair word. But yeah, I mean, really what happens is the more you do that you think is impossible, the more you realize things are possible. So I remember the first time I went to Paris, I thought going in the catacombs was the craziest thing in the world. I schlepped down some abandoned train tracks and threw a hole in the ground, and I was utterly terrified. I was, you know, we were there, and I was like, what in the world are we doing? This is insane. And since that trip, I've been in the catacombs probably 5 or 6 times. I've camped out down there. And, you know, I've been down there for days, and it's just a comfortable part of my world now. So really the wonderful thing about doing this and kind of expanding your comfort zone and getting a little bit beyond what the guidebooks tell you is it changes you, and it changes your perception of the world, and it makes you really realize what's out there and what's possible.
Well, let's start with the catacombs of Paris. Of course, there are the official tours where the bones are neatly stacked. You went into places where bones were just thrown.
Yeah,
basically you're walking
not,
on bones.
If people aren't paying €8 to see it, they're not going to stack them up nice and neat.
And in fact, the catacombs of Paris are literally the whole underground of Paris. You can get lost there. In fact, there are,
you had to have maps. Oh yeah. So you definitely have to have a map. People who know the catacombs well don't need a map. I maybe would go down there without a map on a dare at this point, but I probably shouldn't. So there's about 170 miles of tunnels underneath the 14th arrondissement of Paris, and that's just one network. There's other smaller networks. There's one under the 13th arrondissement that I've never been to that I really want to go to. That's definitely my next destination next time I'm in Paris. But it's just amazing. It's like a Dungeons & Dragons dungeon. It really is. It's the kind of thing where you look at it and you're just like, did somebody draw this, you know, in their parents' basement with, you know, rolling 12-sided die and things like that? It's labyrinthine. And it's amazingly just fun to go and wander and find what's down there.
There's actually an area where, in certain circles of Paris, it's pretty well known. People go down there all the time. It's, like a Times Square?
So this has been brought up several times, and I need to clarify that nobody in Paris calls it the Times Square of the Catacombs. That's terminology that I completely made up, and all my Parisian friends are going to hate me forever that I have called that area the Times Square of the Catacombs. But there is a whole culture. In fact, there's probably 2 or 3 different subcultures that revolve around the catacombs. In Paris, it's certainly off the beaten trail. It's certainly not something that everybody does or anything like that, but it's probably something that's in the public consciousness, and there's definitely a lot of people that go into the catacombs and not just go to explore and wander around. They go to make art or to open certain sections up or to throw parties or to do a whole bunch of stuff. The last time I was there, I ran into one guy who had been camping out down there for, I want to say, a couple of months at least.
And in fact, when you camped out, the thing about it is it's a pretty constant, what, about 55 degrees or something like that? It's like a cave, 98% humidity. But the whole thing is if you're actually sleeping on the floor, the catacombs just suck all the heat out of you.
So if anybody there is contemplating a catacomb trip...
By hammock.
I sometimes have a tendency to be like, we'll be fine. Let's just go. So I had a sleeping bag. My friend Steve, who was with me, didn't even have a sleeping bag. He had, you know, a coat and a little foil blanket. And we tried to sleep down there, and I would swear I thought I was going to get hypothermia. It was the worst sleep of my life. And the next time I went, I brought a hammock. And there's several places where the cataphiles have hung hammock hooks in various little rooms in the catacomb. And if you have a hammock and you're not actually making contact with the ground, it's great. It's really one of the best sleeps you'll have in your life because it is pitch black and no sound. It's almost like sensory deprivation down there.
Hmm. In the catacombs, you visited the tomb of a gentleman named Philibert, who had actually gotten lost in the late 1700s, and he wasn't found till the early 1800s, I think, if I remember correctly.
Philibert is a bit of a legend, yes.
Yeah.
So he was looking for the wine of the monks of Chartreuse, if I remember correctly. The catacombs were developed over a long period of time. They're all old limestone quarries. The history of the catacombs is that Paris started on the Ile de la Cite in the Seine, and for hundreds of years was not that big size-wise. It was, you know, a couple islands in the Seine and a little bit around. And in order to build things like the Louvre or the Notre Dame, you needed materials. And the place you got those materials was from limestone quarries on what was then the outskirts of the town. So the outskirts of Paris are riddled with these old limestone quarries. Some date back to the Roman era, even. In the 1700s, the city really starts to expand. That's when Paris really became a modern metropolis. And it started to expand over all of these old limestone quarries. And you get a huge problem, which is that you're building something and it falls into an improperly stabilized limestone quarry in the ground, and it's not a very good situation. So back when Philibert was searching for the wine of the monks of Chartreuse, it wasn't this huge, completely interconnected network yet. It was still a little bit patchwork down there. In the late 1700s, a little bit before Philibert got lost, is when France created an agency that is the oldest governmental agency in France still to this day. This is during the reign of the Bourbon kings, Louis XVI, if I remember right. And this agency was charged with tunneling underneath the city to find these abandoned limestone and gypsum quarries and stabilize them. And that's why there's a huge interconnected network down there. It's because of all these inspection tunnels that were dug to try to find all of the old underground stuff down there.
Of course, one of the things in all of your explorations is you learn a great deal of history. For example, in the catacombs, you started seeing these strange dates, like 3G14R. And in fact, that was the way French, after the revolution, that was their dating system. They were going by the 14th year of the Republic.
I mean, and it's incredible. And I didn't know that when I went down there. I ran into it and I was like, what's this? And the guy I was with explained it to me. But you won't find that above ground. That is the coolest thing about exploring, really. You know, you're not going to find something above ground that says 13R outside of a museum or, you know, a purposefully preserved thing. It's only down in the catacombs where you don't have the everyday life and everyday development going on that you're going to find those old relics. It was really incredible to kind of come face to face with them.
In the course of your book, you talk about going through the subways, finding abandoned subway platforms, but you also go up high. And another example of that is when you wanted to visit some of the closed observation decks in some of the buildings. And now I guess it's just the Empire State Building. Maybe there might be a new one now after 9/11. But you went to the Williamsburg Savings Bank Tower, which is actually in Brooklyn. And you climbed the observation deck there. And there you found an interesting history lesson all the same.
Yeah. After the World Trade Center was destroyed in 2001, we only had one observation deck, which was the Empire State Building. In 2000 and I want to say 5, it might have been 2006, we got a second one, which is the Rockefeller Center observation deck. But still, we are one of the most visited cities in the world. We have 8 million people. We have over 20 million people in the metropolitan area. And we have as many observation decks, no offense to Kansas City, as Kansas City does. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where I think we could really stand another observation deck or two to open. And we had, before World War II, dozens of observation decks in New York City that were open to the public.
Basically, anytime you build a tall building, you had to put an observation deck because you were proud of the building you built.
Exactly. I mean, we used to have real pride, and we still have pride, but that pride was expressed by wanting to show off to the general public. You know, you built this beautiful building, you want everybody to see it, you want everybody to be able to go in and ooh and ah and go up to the top and say, wow, it's so incredible they built this. That's where you got pride from. And now it seems like we've kind of lost that pride a little bit, and that a lot of the owners of these beautiful skyscrapers are, you know, not as open about showing off to the public or letting people in or letting people up.
But in this case, you went to Williamsburg Savings Bank Tower. It's in Brooklyn. It was the tallest building in Brooklyn, is that right?
Not only the tallest building in Brooklyn, it was the tallest building between Manhattan and Paris for a very long time. It was built in 1929, and until, I want to say, the 1980s was the tallest building between Manhattan and Paris. And it has these old observation decks, and one day, we decided to try to get on them. We walked into the building. It was offices, mostly dentist's offices at the time. We found an empty office, and we managed to get out a window and down a ladder onto the old decks. And I was expecting, hey, we'll get a nice view. You know, this will be kind of cool. And what happened is we ran into another one of those little old remnants of history like we ran into in the catacombs. for the bicentennial in 1976, they had put up signs all about the Battle of Brooklyn on this abandoned observation deck. And the Battle of Brooklyn was a battle in the early days of the Revolutionary War that we lost.
It's where the British invaded New York, basically.
Yeah, the British landed in Brooklyn and invaded what was then Long Island. Brooklyn is technically part of Long Island, the island of Long Island. Invaded Long Island and routed the American troops until the American troops had to retreat from Fulton Ferry Landing in Brooklyn in the middle of the night to Manhattan. And it's considered a brilliant tactical retreat on the part of George Washington and really something that saved the Continental Army and allowed us to eventually win the war. And the coolest thing is you're up there and you have this old sign that tells this story about Washington's night retreat, and you're looking right at where it happened. It's one of those things where when I was in high school, even in college, history was cool, but didn't really excite me that much. And it's really that personal interaction with history and seeing these things up close that really excite people about it, and that I think is really valuable for people to try to go and see themselves.
My guest today is Moses Gates. He's an urban planner and an assistant professor of demography at Pratt Institute. He's also a New York City licensed tour guide, but the explorations he's talking about are probably the one the city's not licensing. His memoir is titled Hidden Cities, A Memoir of Urban Exploration. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Tell us about how you got started climbing bridges. That sounds incredibly scary. And actually, when you were writing about climbing the first one, the Manhattan Bridge, I really felt for you. You're talking about climbing a 200-foot ladder and about 1,500 feet up. All the strength out of your arms has gotten on just from holding on because you're climbing with no climbing equipment. You're just climbing the bridge.
Well, so since that, which was a long time ago, I have actually become a better climber. I've been doing a lot of rock climbing, so you know I think I could handle it a little bit better now. But being on top of a bridge is an amazing view. And it's something where you have two separate kinds of separation. You have a vertical separation, like an observation deck, but you also have a horizontal separation, like being across a river from a city. And you get those two views at once, and it's really the only place you can get both of those views at once. And it's absolutely incredible. And in Australia, they actually have a bridge climb that you can do as a tourist that, if I ever go to Australia, I'm definitely doing, called the Sydney Harbour Bridge Climb,
right,
which is this beautiful arch bridge over Sydney Harbour. And they have another one in Auckland, New Zealand, and they have another one in Brisbane, Australia. And I really think it's the kind of thing that, you know, we could have in a bunch of different places. I think there would be a lot of demand for it because that view is so unique. And I think that it's something that would, you know, help tourism, help the economy, and really provide a great service or a great experience to a lot of different people. I think it would be a great thing to do.
One of the things you're right, you've said several times, we, and in fact, you've found there's a community of people who do the same exact thing as you do. They're visiting these catacombs, these places that are off limits to the general public, and exploring. Can you talk a little bit about the community?
There's a loose-knit, I would say, community. I'd say actually several loose-knit networks is a better word than community, where, you know, especially in the days where you have social networking and everything like that, it's easier to find folks, not just in our little network, but any kind of hobby or any kind of subculture around the world. And you can exchange stories, and it becomes a neat thing because you get networked with this kind of worldwide crew. But it really is, I want to stress, it really is for everybody an individual thing. There's no defining thread. There's no defining, you know, rules or culture or anything like that. Everybody's got their own interests and everybody has their own methods.
Let me ask you about the other part of this story, which is the fact that you are going beyond the signs that say nobody allowed beyond this point. And you're always, at the very least, you're taking a risk of being charged with trespassing if you're caught. In fact, the book opens, you're on top of Notre Dame Cathedral, and you foolishly decide to ring the bell.
Well, you know, we all make a mistake or two, you know, during these kind of things.
So, for example, I would think since 9/11 and certainly all the terrorism events in London, that authorities would pretty much really frown on you. In fact, you found that there's a wide tolerance or a variety of tolerance between cities. Who's the most restrictive? Who's the most loose?
I don't know if there's anything where it's like the most restrictive or the most loose.
Even London?
I wouldn't put it like that. The way I would put it is it's really obvious that everything that urban explorers do comes out of a place of appreciation and a place of love for the cities. And I think that's really easy to see, and I think that's really easy to understand, and I don't think anybody is threatened by that, for lack of a better term. And I also think that people should know about their cities, and people should have knowledge about their cities, and more knowledge is always the route to safety. You know, if you don't know something, if you don't have knowledge about something, it's always so much more dangerous than if you do. So, I mean, that's really the message is it's 2013. We have the internet. We have all sorts of stuff that is out there that is from official agencies and from the government and is good. And I think that, you know, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to, you know, raise the points you did. I think it's really a red herring. I think that it's really obvious that, you know, all this stuff is kind of out of love, that the signs are there, generally speaking, to protect yourself. You know, you don't want somebody to do something dangerous because it might hurt them. That's why, you know, that's why the signs are there. And that's understandable to folks that, you know, don't know, that don't really have that knowledge. So I would say, you know, more knowledge about the city and getting more stuff out there and having more people know and understand the environment they live in, whether that's in the country, whether that's in a city, whether wherever that happens to be, is always the safest route.
Well, there's an incredible picture on the back cover of your book. It shows you on top of the eagle on one of the iconic eagles of the Chrysler Building. Tell us how you get out there.
I mean, that's something. So the eagles are on empty office in the Chrysler Building. I mean, it's the kind of thing where I get asked these questions, you know, how do you do that? How do you get there? What's the secret? There's no secret. There really isn't. It's just, hey, it's pretty much exactly how you think you get there. They just happen to be renovating that particular floor. It's completely empty, and it was, you know, right there. So, of course, if you get a chance to see something like that, you're going to take it.
Yeah. No, it's an incredible photograph. And one of your companions that do this, he's very much into photography, and that's also a subset is people documenting the places they go. You're not so much of a documenter. You just like to experience it yourself, I would say.
So I am not a photographer, really not a very good photographer. There is so much great urban exploration photography out there that it's, to me, I find it silly to try to add one more to it. My good friend Steve Duncan, who's in a lot of the book, is a really wonderful photographer, and you should check out his website at undercity.org if you want to see more and, you know, see more photos from some of the places we went in the book. And you can also check out my website, which is mosesgates.com. Under the links, I try to link to as much urban exploration photography as I can, because there's some really, really beautiful stuff out there. And I think that a lot of people appreciate the city in an aesthetic way, the same way that people appreciate nature in an aesthetic way. And they like not just photographs, but paintings and drawings and art that has to do with nature. I think that's becoming more and more true of the city. And I think that's a really cool thing.
Yeah. You know, in the book, you recount going to places like the Lost Rivers under London. I've never even heard of the Lost Rivers under London. What exactly is this?
Oh, so there's actually Lost Rivers under many cities. Steve is really into Lost Rivers. I'm a little bit less into Lost Rivers. I like abandoned observation.
I would assume it's basically a drainage or a stream that the city is just basically built over, and they conduit underground.
That's exactly what they are. So many cities are built because were originally founded because they had a good harbor, they had good navigation back in the days when trade is all maritime. So that's why lots of cities are by the sea, and cities that aren't by the sea are generally by rivers, or a lot of times confluences of rivers. And those rivers pretty much have tributaries. You know, the Thames has a bunch of tributaries. The Seine had a bunch of tributaries. Any city, Moscow, which was founded on the Moscow River, had lots of tributaries. And those are pretty much true of any great city that's founded on a big river. The problem becomes those tributaries eventually, as the city gets more and more built up, inhibit navigation and they inhibit development. You get tired of building bridges over them. One example is in New York. Canal Street used to actually be a canal and was built over. So a lot of these old underground rivers get built over, and they become part of the storm drain and sometimes sewage system because you already have a natural waterway that's leading out to a drainage point. So it's silly to try to backfill the entire thing. You just turn it into part of the storm drain system. London's rivers got covered up not all at once, but kind of between Elizabethan and Victorian times, they were gradually covered over pretty much.
Now, in the case of London's bridge, they actually took some care. I mean, most of them look like drainage tunnels, but actually the picture, at least in the book, seems to they actually took some care. It looks actually somewhat appealing.
It's actually really beautiful. So that picture was taken by Silent UK, who has a whole bunch of great pictures of underground tunnels and especially drains in not just England, but a lot of different cities around the world. Check them out at silentuk.com. And the thing is, when we build urban infrastructure, it would be easy to just build it functionally. We could throw up a whole bunch of concrete towers. We could throw up a whole bunch of concrete subway stations. We don't have to make things aesthetically appealing, but we do. We want to build beautiful buildings. In Moscow, the subway stations look like palaces.
Right.
We want to build things that are aesthetically pleasing in cities, and the coolest thing is every once in a while, that extends to somewhere where you wouldn't think, like a storm drain, which in England are these gorgeous brick tunnels that, if they weren't a storm drain, you could imagine being somebody's home.
My guest today is Moses Gates. He's an urban planner and assistant professor of demography at Pratt Institute. His story of visiting offbeat places in the urban environment is titled Hidden Cities, A Memoir of Urban Exploration. You know, you started this really as a just fresh out of school urban planner moving to New York City. What has all these experiences informed in your own sense of your own career of teaching demography or urban planning? Have these adventures and these stories of, you know, climbing up on top of bridges, visiting abandoned subway tunnels and subway stations, how's that informed your work as an urban planner?
I have an academic background in urban planning. I teach demography at Pratt Institute, and I always viewed these adventures and these explorations as part of my education. I'm a, for lack of a better way of putting it, professional city guy, and I want to see the city, and it all kind of comes together. It all is part of my education. But to a large extent, these things are very personal, and a lot of times the reason I go to a city to explore the underground or to climb things or even just to walk the streets is just because I enjoy it. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily have any academic value or any social value or anything like that. And I've learned to accept it. I've learned that people have passions and people follow what they love and people like to do things that interest them and make them happy. And it's okay to leave it at that. It really is.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. It is a fascinating look at these places that most people never see in the city. Hidden Cities is the name of the book. Moses, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me. I had a great time.
Moses Gates is an urban planner, an assistant professor of demography at Pratt Institute, a New York City licensed tour guide and urban explorer, and the author of Hidden Cities, A Memoir of Urban Exploration, Travels to the Secret Corners of the World's Great Metropolises. It's published by Tarcher Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. Thanks so much for listening to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher.